is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 194, covering the week of November 4th through November 8th, 2019. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and of course, subscribe to our YouTube page. You can find all those social media buttons at our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll find those buttons. While you're there, give us an email address and we'll give you a free ebook. You'll get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday. While you're also at the abbevilleinstitute.org, of course, it's abbevilleinstitute.org, not the, it's abbevilleinstitute.org. You can click on that support tab and you can give us a few bucks, right? You can donate monthly, annually, or a one-time gift. It's all tax-deductible to the full extent of the law. So if you like what we do, if you like our podcast, if you like our webpage, if you like our conferences, consider a tax-deductible donation. It does go to a good cause. If you want to support the Institute painlessly, just go and click on that Amazon Smile button at the top of our page. You can make us your preferred nonprofit. So while you're shopping at Amazon, you give us a few pennies, and it's a great way. I mean, we make a little money on that for the Institute. So you don't even have to give anything. You can just shop at Amazon like you normally do, and of course, make Jeff Bezos pay us. It's pretty funny. While you're there, just click on that support and on that support tab, and there's a shop button. Click on that, and you can get your Abbeville Institute apparel. It's embroidered stuff, really good, high quality material, golf shirts, t-shirts, hats, golf towels, a lot of great stuff. So you can support the Institute that way. Also, download our free mobile app. Just go to your Google Play or iTunes or Apple, your Apple App Store, and click on look for Abbeville Institute and download the app again free of charge. And you get the Abbeville Institute on the go, the lectures, our podcast, our website, a lot of great stuff. So again, free of charge, painless to do it. And of course, always share our material on social media. If you like what we do, share it on Facebook, Twitter, comment on it. I mean, do these things because this helps people see what we're doing and it gets people interested in the Southern tradition. All right, so let's talk about material for this week. We had a lot of good stuff. We started with a piece by Ben Jones, and of course, Ben Jones being Cooter from the Dukes of Hazzard. Ben is concerned about what we're seeing in America. He's concerned about the Southern tradition and the ability for the Southern tradition to hang on. And the thing I like about Representative Jones, of course, he served in Congress. Ben Jones would not get elected today, particularly as a Democrat, which is what he was, in office. But he's really concerned because he looks at things and he says, you know, this is not what we should be doing in society. And he brings up questions about modern society and what people are saying about things. The title of the piece is What They Don't Want to Hear. And I'm going to read a little bit of this. He makes some very valid points. He says, quite simply, we're up against it. Those whose profession it is to vilify the South and Southern culture and heritage have surrounded us with their perfidious propaganda. They have enormous resources. This is true. They have a national media which is almost entirely woke with the maxims of the radical left. They have hundreds of millions of dollars. We don't. I mean, he and I have talked about this. You know, it's we have pennies compared to these people. And I think we punch harder than our resources. This is why we do ask you to help us financially, because we could do more with more money. It's just a question of how can we do that? And I know a lot of people listen to this show and a lot of people interested in our material don't have a lot of money. And this is why we say, look, I mean, can you give us $3 a month? You know, $3 a month. What's that? It's a Coke at an expensive gas station. $3 a month. You know, can you do that? Can you help us out? Because that would go a long way. If everybody that we have contact with gave us just $3 to $5 a month, well, we would have some serious cash to do some things with. So we wouldn't have the $477 million that the Southern Poverty Law Center has, but we would have more money. He says, our opponents control the entire apparatus of the National Democratic Party. They seemingly have the vast majority of academia. Of course, they have long had the active support of the Hollywood film industry, whose power and influence is a major determinant in American opinion. So, I mean, he's spot on here. Look, we are fighting a war where the other side seems to have all the resources and we have none. The other side seems to control everything and we have none. But I will say this, we have the internet, which is a great equalizer as long as it stays open and free. As long as we can do things like this podcast and our website, people will find us and people are coming around. When we first started, we've grown so much in support and listeners and viewers and people reading our material. There's still plenty of room to grow. I would wish we had the kind of resources that the SPLC has. But at the end of the day, the fact is we are growing. And people are coming around to the Southern tradition. What is true and valuable in the Southern tradition? And the thing that Ben gets into here, which I think is interesting, of course, he continues, he says, what are the things they don't want to hear? And then he has a whole list of this stuff. He says, they don't want to hear that American slavery was a Northern enterprise from beginning to end. They don't want to hear that the Emancipation Proclamation was a cynical political move to influence Britain and France. They don't want to hear that the worst race riots in our history have been in the North. They don't want to hear that slavery existed in all the colonies and in all of our original states. They don't want to hear about Lincoln's belief that black folks and white folks cannot coexist and that blacks should be deported to colonies elsewhere. They don't want to comprehend Lincoln's words in his first inaugural address where he said that slavery was constitutionally legal and that the state should pass the Corn Amendment to make it perpetually protected by the Constitution. They don't want to hear that 12 American presidents owned slaves, as did patriots like Benjamin Franklin and John Hancock. They don't want to hear that hundreds of blacks owned black slaves. They don't want to believe that black Southerners fought for the Confederacy. They don't want to see the war between the states as a terrible event that should have and could have been avoided. They don't want to believe that Lincoln could have withheld the reinforcement of Fort Sumter and extended diplomatic overtures to save the nation. They don't want to hear that Reconstruction was a vindictive punishment that hobbled the South and set the nation back. There was no Marshall Plan for Dixie. They don't want to hear that the American Revolution was won in the South or that 7 of our first 10 presidents were Southerners. They don't want to hear that the current wave of cultural Marxism and its wave of attacks against Southern culture and legacy are doing very real damage to the hard-won progress towards racial equality and understanding that has been made in the last 5 decades. They don't want to hear that our nation is fed up with snowflakes, social justice warriors, and upper-class victims of whatever fashionable oppression is. They don't want to acknowledge that the media has been complicit in censoring voices of dissent. These are things they don't want to hear. So we must continue to raise our voices to the rooftops and press our cause at every chance. We are Southerners, we are of all colors and religions and ages, and we will be heard. So, he's right about this. I mean, look, the establishment, what a colleague of mine calls the cathedral, is dangerous. I mean, it's worshipped as you would a religion. And when you oppose that, well, they're going to put all the resources they can in crushing you. That's the point. They don't want you to be in a situation where you have enough voice to oppose them. So it's really important that we think about how we can fight back. And I think, one of the things that we do, of course, is with the Institute. It's how we're fighting back. We're trying. And I think pieces like this go a long way. You know, Ben Jones is a moderate guy. He's just saying, I'm tired of this stuff. I'm fed up with it. And he's lived in the South. He grew up on the wrong side of the tracks. His story is really interesting. Of course, worked in Hollywood, knew about the establishment. He's been everywhere with the establishment. He knows these people, and he knows how they work, and he knows that what's happening is just wrong. And I think a lot of Americans see this, which is why they're so willing to listen to what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. And in that way, the piece on Wednesday that I wrote, Taylor and Jefferson on Secession, here are two important individuals in the founding generation. One, of course, well-known, Thomas Jefferson. The other, not so much, John Taylor of Caroline. Now, if you listen to this podcast and you read our website, you'll know that John Taylor of Caroline is an important figure. You'll know that he is one of the most important figures in the Southern tradition. But this particular exchange that these two men had in June and July of 1798 is really interesting because it gets down, they start talking about scission, which is what Jefferson and Taylor called it, S-C-I-S-S-I-O-N, scission, not secession, but scission. And what's interesting about it is that Jefferson has a perspective that is much different than Taylor. But at the end of the day, Taylor has said some things that are so important for our understanding of American society and American political society. But first, Jefferson, look, Taylor said, well, maybe a scission would be preferable to what we're going through. And of course, Taylor was approached by two Northerners in 1794 who proposed that we have a break in the Union. And Taylor was shocked about this. In 1794, 5 years after the Constitution was put into effect with the first Congress, we're already talking about secession. But here we are in 1798. We're just getting to the point where we have the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. And Jefferson says something that I found, I mean, this is a very famous letter on his part, and it's been cited. Clyde Wilson has cited it before, but Jefferson agreed, I say, that Virginia was under the yoke of Massachusetts, and quote, this is Jefferson's words now, they ride us very hard, cruelly insulting our feelings as well as exhausting our strength and substance. Their natural friends, the three other eastern states, join them from a sort of family pride, and they have the art to divide certain other parts of the Union so as to make use of them to govern the whole. So he's already pointing out in 1798 that New England is trying to control the United States to punish the South. This is what George Mason worried about when the Constitution was going through debate and, of course, ratification. He worried about that. He said, you know, this is going to be highly problematic. This led in Jefferson's mind to a political problem in America, for he thought that, quote, the body of our countrymen is substantially Republican through every part of the Union. It was the irresistible influence and popularity of General Washington played off by the cunning of Hamilton, which turned the government over to anti-Republican hands, or turned the Republican members who were chosen essentially into stooges for the administration. So Jefferson worried about what Hamilton and had done in office. And this is what everyone worried about with Hamilton. This is why Alexander Hamilton screwed up America, and why I've said that, why I wrote a book about that. And, of course, Jefferson's response to all this was that, you know, I don't think we should worry about dividing up the Union, because if you divide up the Union, then you're just going to have New England leaves and Pennsylvania will take their place and Virginia and Pennsylvania will slug it out. And then if we leave there, then it's going to be North Carolina and Virginia or Georgia and Virginia. So it's never going to solve anything. What we really need to do is vote better. Vote better. This is an interesting position. So if we simply vote better, of course, according to Jefferson, things will get better. We'll get better Republicans. Taylor's response was not so fast. Wait a second. If you're saying that it's just going to be voting better, I mean, how long is that going to take? And if we've already got these tyrants in office and you're already producing a climate that's anti-Republican, well, will that not be a situation then where you will not groom any future Republicans because they won't be able to grow in this anti-Republican environment? So would it not be better just to leave? But then Taylor also brought up a position, well, if this is the case, then maybe we need to reform the document. I mean, here we are 10 years into this. We see what works and what doesn't work. And maybe it's time for some reform. So he offered, you know, maybe we need to have extend the suffrage. Maybe we need to think about having some amendments to the Constitution that will prohibit taxation. That's an important one. He thought that taxation was the way that the central government could keep its power. Maybe having annual elections would do things. Maybe having a different way of checking bad legislation. But the fact is, Taylor was thinking about these things, and he thought that it was already time to think about changing the Constitution. We have this reverence for the Constitution that's really unjustified, I think, in a lot of ways. The Constitution is okay as long as everyone follows it, but it is ambiguous. It has the ability to be molded and formed into what the nationalists have always wanted, which is why there were those who were opposed to it. And it has this presidency that has this open-ended power structure that seems to be very dangerous. So when you look at what the Constitution is and you look at these things, it's certainly a document that opens the door to abuse of power. And Taylor was concerned about that. And this is part of the Southern tradition. I mean, people think that somehow this stuff was invented in 1861. It wasn't. Southerners were talking about problems of the center all the way back in the 18th century. The compact fact of the Constitution is just that, a compact fact. And Taylor's choice of how to change, how to reform these problems was simply relying on the compact fact of the Constitution. We need the states to take the power that they naturally have and use that power to their advantage. He said, most important was his belief that the only entity powerful enough to check the center was the states. In Taylor's view, the right of the states to expound the Constitution made them the natural repositories of liberty. But if that didn't work, as Taylor suggested, the people in state conventions are incontrovertibly the counteracting parties, and possessing the impinging rights may proceed by orderly steps to attain the object of course, reform. That sounds like the compact fact of the Constitution. So, here we have John Taylor of Caroline saying things in 1798 that are often thought that were, you know, made up in 1861. The Southerners weren't really committed to these things until 1861. It was all about slavery. Yet this particular series of letters is all about taxation. So these things go back farther than just the 1850s or the 40s or the 30s. In fact, the first people to really start bristling at anti-slavery were not in the South, they were in the North. Because this is where it was ended first, and all the early pro-slavery treatises were written in the North, what Ben Jones was talking about. Yet somehow the South is just all about racism and slavery. If we only listen to the Southern tradition, some things would be a lot better in the United States. This is why the Southern tradition is still true and valuable. I offer that piece as an 18th century look at the compact fact of the Constitution. And with that said, when you look at how important the states are, when you look at how important these things are, and I want to focus on the Friday piece, and I'll come back to the Thursday, and I want to focus on the Friday and Tuesday piece. I'll say that. When you talk about decentralization, you look at political order. One of the things we talk a lot about, of course, is the primacy of community and people together in a community and localities and homogenous people and people with common culture and customs. Look, there's nothing wrong with northern customs if they stay in the North. I mean, people do things in the North the way they want to do them, and if they just simply let the South alone and let the South do what they want to do, but that's not the way of the Yankee who wants to come into the South and bring the North with him. Or her. But the main point of the Southern tradition is that belief in the local, that belief in family, kith and kin, where you're from being more important than what you do. And we do this a lot at the Abbeville Institute as well and talk about these things. And the piece on Friday by Walt Garlington, overextending political loyalties. He says something that's really important near the end of the piece. He says, but the Union is too vast and abstract for us to properly love. We must know and love the local, what we can see, touch, hear, taste, and smell. I cannot experience a snowstorm in the Dakotas or the steady rain in the evergreens around Spokane, but I can touch the snowbells growing in my yard in Louisiana and watch and listen to the creek flowing behind the house. The country presents a limit for our affections. The average size of a country in the 50 states is about, I'm sorry, the county, excuse me, presents a limit for our affections. The average size of a county in the 50 states is about 1,200 square miles. This would make a square of about 35 miles long and wide with a border length of about 140 miles in all. If a man walked an average pace around the border 8 hours a day with no breaks, it would take him no less than 5 days to complete the circuit. Within that boundary lies an astounding variety of life. Each surname of each family who lives within it contains the deeds of a clan across the generations down to the mythic past. The walls of each home have witnessed numerous acts of the human drama, the dark ugliness of sin, the radiant beauty of virtue, the steady rhythms of a normal day, and behind and beheld of the work of the muses, poems, music, songs, paintings. Each church in town has its founding story and first members. Each graveyard and battlefield has numerous tales to share with us. The Indian mounds call to us the communion with the first peoples here. The hills, trees, lakes, mosses, rocks, grasses, beasts, flowers, insects, birds, fish, mountains, rivers, caves, and the like each present an inexhaustible source of enjoyment, whether through active observation, exploration, or simply while watching and contemplating. It would take not 5 days, but 5 lifetimes to fully appreciate the contents of a single county. County is big enough, he says, and this is what we should be thinking about. He concludes with the little community is the touchstone of the South, not the great girth of the national Leviathan. Dixie does not need the ideologies that issue from Washington, D.C., or every new gadget that comes from the bowels of MIT and Silicon Valley. Just the church, the family, the county courthouse, and the other places where no human interaction takes place. Much of the weighty matters of life should be discussed and decided in them firstly, but does the South still have ears to hear the pleading voices of her past, he wonders. It's poetic in what he's saying, but it's true. I mean, we have this tradition that is local, and it needs to be reinforced. And if you look at the Tuesday piece, it was a book review of a collection of essays by the Haskell family in South Carolina. And it's collected by Karen Stokes, who's one of our writers, and Clyde Wilson reviewed it. But here you have a collection of family letters that give you an insight into that small, that community, and what these people thought, and all the things they went through, and all the things they struggled with, of course, during the war, which is a big part of it. But also, just everyday family life. These were real people. They're not abstractions. And I think sometimes we forget that. They just become slaveholder or abolitionist or whatever thing we want to attach to them. But these are real people with real desires and feelings and thoughts and humor or not. They're people just like us. And they struggle with things. And so when we try to put our present values on them, we create real problems. But they have much to teach us. Every generation does. On my own podcast, I've talked about Richard Weaver and his question, which ancestors do we follow? I mean, tradition can be everything. He's saying we don't want to do that. We want to pick the tradition. And of course, every tradition has what's true and valuable. Every tradition has its thorns. We've discussed that on this podcast as well. And so what happens with the left is they just want to bulldoze, they want to mow down the Rose Garden, which is the South, because it's got some thorns on it. But really, the rose should be cherished and treasured. And that rose is what the beautiful part of the Southern tradition. And unfortunately, we don't pay attention to that rose as much as we should. Now, the last thing I want to talk about for this week is the piece on Thursday, which is The Real Reason for Civil War Monuments. And we've done this a lot, but this is a different one. It's by Ernest Blevins. He's not written for us before, but did a lot of work and created this beautiful little chart about these monuments. And what he did is he didn't just go out and look at Confederate monuments, because you can't win the argument with that, because the left is so ideologically driven about these things and how bad they are. What he did is he said, I'm going to look at not just Confederate monuments, but Union monuments. When were Union monuments constructed? When did people in the North start building monuments? And lo and behold, what did he find? Well, about the same time there was a burst of activity for Confederate monuments, the Union was building a lot of monuments at the exact same time the North was, at the exact same time. In fact, the North started building monuments long before the South did, because they had the means and the money to do it. And then you get, and he points it out, you get the 25th anniversary, a lot of Union monuments built around the 25th anniversary. The 50th anniversary is the big one. Of course, a ton of monuments built in the South right around the 50th anniversary. Lo and behold, I mean, that just wouldn't make any sense. And there was a ton of them built in the North around the exact same time. And he also mentions that there's very few Northern monuments that really even mention slavery. Some do. But the fact is, most of them mention the men who died in the war, fighting for the Union. The same exact thing that's being mentioned in the South. In fact, this was a spirit of reconciliation. You had your heroes who fought and died, and by gosh, we had our heroes who fought and died, and you know what? It's okay. We're going to put down the sword, we're going to put down the rifle, and we're going to hold, we're going to shake hands across the chasm. We're going to try to get on with the business of keeping this union together now. But that was the spirit of reconciliation. You can put up your monuments and we'll celebrate it. If we're in the North, we'll celebrate Robert E. Lee. He's a great American. If we're in the South, we'll celebrate Abraham Lincoln. He was a great American. At the end of the day, we need to do that so that we can make the United States a prosperous place. And Southerners eagerly joined up to go fight in foreign wars. They went and fought in the Spanish-American War. They went and fought in World War I. They did these things because they wanted to show that they were part of the Union. And that was essential to them. It was important to them. So I think at times we forget this. And this is why I like about the piece. Because everyone says, well, they were building these things during the era of Jim Crow. Okay, it was also the 25th, the 40th, the 50th anniversary. That might have had something to do with it. He surveyed over 400 monuments for each side. It's a lot of work. In contrast to what the SPLC says, these monuments were put up during these time frames, not because of white supremacy or pro-slavery, any of the nonsense that the SPLC likes to say, but because they were put up to honor dead soldiers and to honor Southerners. To honor Robert E. Lee, considered a great American across both sections. E.L. Godkin, the abolitionist, libertarian essentially, but the abolitionist, said that Thomas J. Jackson was going to be an American hero, not just a Southern hero, that the North should also claim him as one of theirs because he represented, he embodied everything that was good about America, not just the South. You see, E.L. Godkin could say that in the late 19th century because we didn't have this nastiness of woke leftism. It's okay to say that we have heroes, people that we may not always agree with, but that we can find the good in them. The North, the people that were being shot at were willing to accept Southerners. I was watching a little video today on the sinking of the German battleship, the Tirpitz. And it's focuses on the Royal Air Force, which was responsible for that. And this great battleship, the German battleship, and a fearful machine. And the effort to do it. And they had on some of the sailors and some of the, from the Tirpitz itself, these men in their 90s now, and interviewing them, and they were also interviewing some of the men who flew in the Royal Air Force, who dropped the bombs, and then they had a pilot, a German pilot. The Germans had stationed some Messerschmitt pilots nearby to try to protect the battleship, and it just didn't work out. There's a reason why, but I don't want to get into all that. And they had this pilot on, and they had this Royal Air Force navigator, I believe. I can't remember what his position was in the Royal Air Force, but he was on the bombing raid. And the two men, when they were older, they're friends now. And at first, the member of the Royal Air Force didn't really want to talk to the German. The German didn't mind talking to the men from Britain, but they became very good friends, and they don't talk about the war. And they recognized that they had to do what they had to do. And one of the Brits at the end said, you know, I think about these things now, and there were a lot of people killed when we sank that battleship. But if we had to, he said, war is horrible, but if we had to, we'd do it over again because we didn't want the Nazis ruling Britain. And the German pilot wept at the end because thinking about the men that died, thinking about his fellow comrades. And the British soldiers, I mean, these were men that were considered to be vile, that they considered Nazis, of course, to be vile, horrible people. But at the end of the day, they were soldiers and they could respect their position as soldiers. And you see this across the board in World War II. And yet we don't bat an eye at that. When a U.S. soldier says, you know, I respect the Germans. They were good soldiers. They were good men. I respected them. We don't bat an eye at this anymore. But yet somehow we can't say that about Americans. We can't say that I respect Southern soldiers. They were good men. They were just doing what they were told to do. They were out fighting me. This is what we can't, because these people are demons. You see, it's hypocritical and it's sad, but it's where we are because of wokeness. And Barack Obama came out and said, we can't do this anymore. We can't be offended by everything that happens. Now, of course, Obama is being hypocritical. He started some of this stuff. But the fact that he's come out and said, you know, this is silly. What we're going way too far with this. But once you open the box, once you open Pandora's box, it's very hard to close it. You can't really, and you let the you can't do any of these things. So we have to be very careful with that. But the whole point of our existence here at the Abbeville Institute is to try to show that there is a valuable side to the South. It's the Southern tradition. People that love it are not bad people. People that love it actually have something good to say and productive to say about American society. Walt Garlington has something productive to say about American society. Ben Jones has something productive to say about American society. Clyde Wilson, Karen Stokes, the Haskells from the 19th century have something productive to say about American society. John Taylor of Carolina and Thomas Jefferson have something valuable to say about American society. Do we live in their world? No, but as Richard Weaver said, we probably wouldn't want to, but they can teach us how to live. We wouldn't want to live in the 19th century. We wouldn't agree with much of what they do, but they can teach us how to live in a lot of different ways. And that's what we should be thinking about as we go through what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Until next time, good day.